Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Be excellent to yourself, dude.
And the music will save the world.
Yes, put your headphones on while you're doing your homework.
It's important because music puts you in the right headspace.
Yeah.
The musical tones of the Skype dialing is like way too cheery and makes me mad. It's like, here comes a phone call. I'm like, no, just don't do that.
No. It used to be better when it was just sort of a nondescript.
The bloopy noises.
Yeah, and then now it's like, be happy, and it's like, nope.
Don't want to be happy.
You can't
Don't
make
tell me
me.
what to, don't tell me what to do, Skype.
You're not the boss of me.
I just noticed there's ink all over my AirPods case sitting in front of me. I don't know where that came from.
That's not good.
Yeah. You don't have the AirPods, or do you?
No, I've got the Beats X, Beats 10, whatever.
Yeah. Are those the ones that just they're just like a little squishy nub that you shove into your ear?
Well, they have several different squishy nubs.
Like interchangeable squishy nubs?
Yes.
I should have got those for Amanda instead of the ones that have the squishy nub and then also the little hook thing that goes around the ear. They're the other Beats ones. Which ones are those?
Oh, the Power Beats, I
Yeah, I
think.
got her those, and she doesn't use them.
No, I don't like behind the ear things. They bother me.
Well, she
They're
likes it for running, but not like daily life.
yeah. I think the Beats 10 maybe. I think it has like these little like it looks sort of like Batman cowl, pointy things that you can put on to in addition to the earpiece part.
Oh, right. They're supposed to be shaped like the groove in your ear, so they like don't fall
Yeah,
out
but
more.
it's been so long since I have perused what came with it that I don't remember if that's true or not. And I don't, 'cause I don't use those, obviously. But it's got the W one chip, good old W.
Yeah, Amanda still loves her old school wired in-ear headphones back before the ear pods became a thing. They were the squishy nub ones that were like the extra the one up price. I don't remember what they
Wait,
cost. They
wait.
were like $80 or something.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So is she using the adapter? The headphone
Oh
adapter?
yeah. Oh yeah. All day, every day.
No.
Yeah.
No, I can't. I've tried on airplanes and stuff, and it just
Yeah.
there's just something about it too, like aesthetically, just looking at this little tiny white piece of plastic attached to the, because I obviously don't use the white ear pods that come with the thing because those fall right out of my ears. But I have just like some black Panasonic earbuds or some black Skullcandy ones, which were super cheap.
You buy those at the airport?
Yeah, well, I basically have solved the problem of not having enough earbuds in my life by just putting them everywhere. So my apartment and Jason's apartment in the bag I take to work, like everywhere there is an here or there, everywhere. There are earbuds for me. But then they screwed everything because now you need an adapter if you want to use your phone. So
Yeah,
I don't use
well,
those.
with small earbuds, it's not that big a deal. But I use the adapter on airplanes because I bring my big old Sennheiser headphones to drown everything out so I can like fall asleep. But it is ridiculous that this like massive, heavy coiled cable is just like dangling from this little white piece of plastic.
Yeah. Oh wait, are these the Sennheisers that install root malware on your machines?
No, these ones are 12 years old or something. There is no technology in them whatsoever. They are just big old headphones.
Oh, that's good.
Although I do want to get some wireless headphones because wires are stupid. But apparently I got to be careful about that now.
Yeah, I would not recommend Sennheiser if you
I
choose to
like
do that.
Sennheiser. I like my Sennheisers. They're good. They're soft. They make loud noise.
Yeah, I'm. There's, well, there's the Beats over the ear ones that have the W1 chip in them too. But I don't like over the ear headphones.
You mean
If
over
that's
the
your thing,
ear,
you could do that.
on ear, or whatever, the ones that have like the tiny poof, or the one that cover completely subsumes your
The
ear?
ones that cover your ear and then have a band that sits across the top of your head.
Oh yeah, I love those. My Sennheisers are big boys.
I hate those. There's something about the band part resting on my head
Yeah.
that I hate it. And then if I try to like adjust it up so that it's high enough off my head that I don't feel it, then slowly they sink, and then it touches again, and then there's nothing to do about it.
The band is there to keep the headphones in place.
But it's really incredibly uncomfortable and bothersome. And I know it's a personal thing, because, like, there are a lot of people who love them, but I hate them. And I see some people, you know, where they rock the band on the back, where they, like, rotate the whole thing so that the band is sort of laying across the back of their head.
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
I was briefly watching some early 2000s music videos yesterday, as I occasionally do, just because it is laughable how far society has come since then. And do you remember those headphones that they were kind of like the modern version of your standard, like, Walkman headphones? They had the little poofy earpiece, but it also had those weird little ear hooks, and then the hard plastic thing that connected them went behind your head.
Yeah.
Oh God, I had some of those things, and they were so uncomfortable. If you wear them long enough, they just leave just these horrible dents in the tops of your ears. But that was nope. The hip thing to do.
No, I don't like any of that stuff. But yeah, just I want little earbuds that sit comfortably, and are soft and made out of a soft, flexible material, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I might investigate some other wireless options for the lady, because she doesn't like the other ones. But I'm generally good with my AirPods, unless I need to drown out the entire world, then I go with the big old Sennheisers. But again, that cable is, like, really heavy, like, absurdly heavy. So I, like, try to tuck the cable into my pocket or something, because it will just yank my phone straight to the ground. It's so heavy.
Yeah, Jason used, when he used to travel with the Bose Quiet Comfort, I want to say 20s. They're just a regular headphone jack part, and then there's a like battery compartment thing in the middle of the cable for noise reduction.
All right.
You know those things. And so he it comes with, like, a little traveling case that you put the whole thing inside of, and the charging cable for that and everything. It's a whole boondoggle of a thing. But he brings that on flights and stuff. He's like, this is so annoying. It doesn't work right with the adapter. Something about the noise reduction stuff doesn't quite work out. And he's like, but I don't want to drop all this money on another pair of the Quiet Comforts to get exactly what I have, but wireless. And so he kept complaining about that for a while. And then he just said, screw it, I'm going to get AirPods. And because he initially had opposed them because they don't have noise cancellation. But now he has them, and he's just like, oh, these are the best things ever. You know how convenient these are? And I've seen him walking around with them in his ears, and I'm just like, I can't believe you're just like a total dork like that. Like,
they're great headphones. They don't work great on airplanes because they don't, like, cover your ear and block everything out. Like, on an airplane, one time I didn't have my Sennheisers. I just had my AirPods, so I put them in, and then I just, like, cupped my hands around my ears and pressed in a little bit, and it drowned out the airplane, and it sounded way better.
Yeah. Oh, I think he's just gotten to the point where he just jacks up the volume on it, but I'm sure that's great for his hearing. And
yeah,
well, no,
I'm deaf
effects.
Too. Like, I'm almost rocking full volume on, like, the big headphones on the airplane, just to, like, you know, drown out the people, quiet the demons in your head, whatever you got
to
do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to listen to your heavy metal.
Sometimes, mm-hmm. Sometimes
your Wild Stallions.
My Wild Stallions. I had to look up the song that they played at the end here when they learn how to play music, and then they play a musical song to win the Battle of the Bands. I was like, I know that song. It's not obviously one of the more famous songs, but it's a Kiss song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not a big Kiss fan.
No, me neither. In fact, I think this is one of those things that's interesting about the Bill and Ted franchise. I don't like any of the rock that they use, but somehow they take over the world. I don't know.
I like that they had the cameo from the Faith No More guy. Like, that was good. That's probably the closest thing I'll get to being able to listen to music that's in the movie.
Yeah,
even though there's no Faith No More music in the movie.
I don't think I know anything about Faith No More.
You do. If you heard some of their songs, you'd be like, oh yeah, that was on the radio when I was growing up, and then I just didn't know what it was.
Okay, so why does he say station?
I assume it's a time loop thing, because they find the station in the future and then take it back to the past to help with things, and then station becomes one of the beloved characters in the the Bill and Ted, royal family or something, and then becomes respected in the future, and it becomes a catchphrase.
Yeah, but he's not from the future.
That's a good point.
Yeah, because I was wondering about that, because when you first see him, and he steps out of the little booth at the beginning, he says station, and then I thought maybe this has something to do with Faith No More's, you know, oeuvre, their works. I have no idea. But then, because Bill and Ted also say station a couple times throughout the course of the film before they meet Station, and I'm like, why would they say that? Is that a thing? Like,
well, I thought it was just because they heard some people saying it in the future, and they're like, oh, I guess that's the catchphrase of the future.
Well, maybe, I guess, but it still doesn't explain the Faith No More guy. But that's the least of the problems with Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Would you agree?
The weird thing about this movie is you have a base level of weirdness to start with because it's Bill and Ted mm-hmm. trying to make a movie or something. But like tonally, like they amp up a couple of things, which gets really uncomfortable and weird. And then in the background, it's also just like, oh yeah, well, you know, we gotta save the world. We gotta be the future of, you know, world peace and stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And there's just that really like soft undertone of that the whole time that they're doing these like really weird things with clones and robots and death and stuff.
Yeah, this movie is very poorly written. And it's by the writers of the first one. So I don't know what was going on. The first one...
I mean, it seems like a logical conclusion. You're like, all right, what are we going to do? Well, there needs to be another turning point in their lives where they make a fundamental decision that leads them on the path to world peace, greatness, etc., and then we're going to have somebody try to thwart it, and it's just going to be some grumpy fringe lunatic in the future who doesn't like Wild Stallion's music and decides that he wants to be the father of the group and put down his own rules.
Yeah, but see, that's the part that doesn't make any sense, because his character has no clear motivation at all.
He's just mad at the music. He doesn't like it.
Yes.
I mean, he's probably more of a classical music guy.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just one of those things where it's just like, why are there like dissidents in this future? It doesn't make any sense. And you could say like, oh, well,
clearly
maybe
world peace didn't work.
Well, maybe they didn't want to wear any sort of ridiculous, you know, foam rubber costumes, but then they also have foam rubber costumes. They're just black. Maybe they just don't like colorful foam rubber costumes.
Yeah, they're not flattering.
Yeah, well, an uplight on certain neck profiles is not flattering either.
Built into the collar of his like spacesuit that doesn't have a glass bubble helmet on it.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's very obviously they're just like, he's just going to be our Darth Vader thing, and so he just kind of looks like Darth Vader in Return of the Jedi when the helmet comes off. He's gonna, you know, even have that moment where he goes through the doors that have exploded after his troopers go through, and then he slowly walks in with his cape swaying, and it's just like, did you guys think that was clever, or was it a cute homage you were trying to go for? Because instead I'm just looking at him walk over the debris that you set off that obviously didn't emanate from the floor because it's intact. You just put dirt on top of it. But this is such a strange duck. I understand, like you said, they need to go back. They need to have another turning point. And it makes sense to have somebody from the future be that person who causes this problem, because otherwise Rufus would have known about it. Rufus, again, returning and played by the great George Carlin. But he's in a fraction of this film.
Underutilized a lot. I mean, not that he had a huge in terms of screen time role in the first movie, but he was more useful and entertaining, and in this one he's just like, oh no, I'm gonna throw a guitar, and then at the end he's like, I was here the whole time.
Yeah. Which is also, that's a weird reveal.
I think it's weird that Pam Grier disrobes and turns into George Carlin.
A little bit. But
they were high when they wrote that. Let's be honest.
Yeah, this movie starts with the future, and the bad guy Chuck DeNomolos is upset and going to overthrow stuff, and he has an evil plan. And then we cut to like some gardens in Van Nuys, and then they go into, I guess, their weird future class and their foam rubber ridiculous things, like their shoes they can barely walk in, etc. And they sit under some UV lights. Yeah, I have to say that the production design of the first movie is ridiculous, but it kind of has a quality to it that doesn't feel as anchored in ideas of the future when the movie was made, whereas this one feels like very much in sync with the style of super colorful neon stuff that was very 1991.
Well, the first one, they had a smaller budget, so like all the future people are just wearing like sequined robes and like blue blockers or something. And this one, they're like, we've got budget, let's build outfits for everyone and stuff.
Yeah, but
and computers.
But it isn't really those outfits don't look like you spent budget on them, because
no.
you can just see where all the
floppy seams everywhere.
Yeah, they're just like, yeah, sure, wraps around here, hot glue that. Like
everyone's wearing spandex, and then they've just got this sort of like exoskeleton of foam.
Yeah, it's to protect them in case they trip and fall over from their shoes. But the
safety first, man.
Yeah, apparently they're all going into this class, which is taught by Rufus, who uses the time machine to bring historical figures.
Yeah, by the way, doesn't that kind of like devalue the time machine a little bit if he's just using it for like history class?
Yes. Also, it seems history class lasts exactly 5 seconds, because he brings the historical figures into the classroom and then says, all right, and remember your homework. And it's like, okay, I guess. Why did you drag them here? What was that for?
Maybe it's an in class session where they get to work on their assignments. Maybe it's like the end of the semester where you get to just work on your project during class time.
Yeah, you take Ben Franklin home with you. I'm sorry. Thomas Edison was here. Ben Franklin was going to be the next class, which is going to be Ben Franklin and Aretha Franklin. But
was it Bach that was there, the musical guest?
Yeah, it was. And also somebody
tonight on Saturday Night Live, Bach.
And they also had the weird, was it 23rd century, 26th century, like, inventor of the whatever machine, and where would we be without that?
Oh, the lady?
Yeah, which I found kind of entertaining, because...
Was she an inventor? I thought she was a musician, too.
Well, she was a musician, but she invented a musical instrument.
Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. As all musicians do. But they are interrupted by the exploding door, which... The door doesn't explode. A small charge goes off, and then black little filament things go flying everywhere, like iron filings. And then the CBS door opens, and in come all of the foot soldiers. And then very slowly, Chuck DeNomolos walks in and says that, ah, ha, ha, and now here are my school books. And he has them to hand out. I don't know why. And he's like, yeah, and I'm going to use my evil plan. And Rufus is like, oh, my old teacher, blah, blah, blah. And it's supposed to be, again, like kind of a Star Wars thing, like, you know, Darth Vader and Obi-Wan, except reversed. But
I would watch a Star Wars movie where George Carlin played Obi-Wan.
Well, it's a little late for that now, but that would have maybe been funny. But the weird thing about George Carlin, part of his stand-up act, he has a whole thing about how he doesn't wash his hands when he pees at a urinal.
Yeah, I think that's probably an act.
You sure?
I'm not sure, no. But,
well,
you know,
you're never going to be faced with the very difficult decision of whether or not you shake George Carlin's hand. But
I would absolutely shake his hand, then I would just go wash my hands.
then you start thinking, which doors did George Carlin touch? But anyway. George Carlin's like, yeah, I know your evil plan won't work and stuff, and then the robot villain Ted are revealed, and then they do the silly goofy rubber mask peel off stuff and the torso peel off gag, which they get to do another time in the film.
Yeah, the peeling the head off through the mouth with the robot skull. I enjoyed that. It took way too long, yeah. But it was kind of funny. And the way they did the undercrank, so they were all like shaky and weird.
Yeah, they just should have done it faster. I have some editing notes for this movie. You know how you're always like, oh, they could have shaved off like 5 frames and it would have been so much better. Well, this is a movie where I feel like there are just seconds of absolutely nothing or shots that just linger on nothing happening or repetitive motion.
The movie's 93 minutes, though. You don't want to shave too much off of that.
But I feel like it's really padded out, you know?
I mean, just even plot-wise, like the whole... The big room would they go to where they mug the people and take their like purple Amish clothes or whatever like that scene doesn't do anything.
No.
Or I guess it's supposed to be like on your way to, supposed to be St. Peter before you got to glowy, Zool God voice.
Yeah. It's just, let's kind of go in order. Cause this is a time travel movie and we should go through it linearly, but, sure. At the beginning, the robots take the time machine to go back, and Rufus uses his grappling hook guitar.
Tell they're bad too because they wear sunglasses.
Yeah, and what I like is literally no one can shoot him, and he's moving in a straight line very slowly across the floor. They didn't even like pull him fast or like crank it up for high speed or anything. Like it was just. Ridiculous. He's just slowly being tugged across the floor by 3 Teamsters. And then he
well they're stormtroopers. They have very poor accuracy.
Yeah, and he falls into the fog machine void where the telephone booth had been. But when the telephone booth materializes out of some liquid nitrogen composited scary sky stuff, he's nowhere to be found. Just the guitar remains, so it's a mystery where he went. Meanwhile, Keanu Reeves as Ted Theodore Logan, and Alex Winter as Bill S. Preston Esquire, Esquire doesn't make any sense, but they are at the Battle of the Bands audition.
Not only does it not make sense, I love what he says, Granny S. Preston Esquire.
I mean, at that point, that's kind of mildly entertaining. But they're auditioning for the Battle of the Bands at the whatever Civic Auditorium for their band, the Wild Stallions. And Pam Grier is there as Miss Wardrow, just spelled exactly like wardrobe, but then you just forgot the B. And then she's like, okay, fine, I'll let you guys go, but you're going to be the last act. And they're like, oh, great. And they go party with the princesses and their parents, and like that whole scene is just bad, really awful.
Bad.
Yeah, they're at their apartment, and you're just like wondering why. And they leave their party in their apartment to go talk to the princesses from the first movie, who are their girlfriends over at the pool. But then they go back to the room later, and it's kind of silly.
By the way, I just noticed one of the princesses, played by Sarah Trigger, is in PCU.
Huh.
She's Jeremy Piven's love interest in the womanist. Is that what they called the group?
I don't know. I'm sorry, Sarah Trigger.
You've seen PCU, right?
It's been a long time.
We should do that one someday. That's problematic on a level of Animal House, I'm sure.
Well, this movie is not without its problems as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems in this movie.
Yeah. So, Bill and Ted, they say goodbye to their girlfriends. They leave in their cars, and they talk about how chaste they are, that they're not there in their apartments with them. That's great commentary. Then they get a phone call from the girlfriends that they're never going to be together ever again, and they're awful, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously, it's not the girlfriends, it's the robots making the call from the phone booth and impersonating the voices, a la Terminator. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, do the whole thing to make Bill and Ted all super sad. And they sit around watching Star Trek reruns that happen to be on TV. And they're
watching Sad Shatner.
Yeah, they're watching Arena, which is the episode where Kirk and the Gorn captain are beamed down to a planet's surface to fight it out rather than having the two ships engage in battle over this planet by some alien force that thinks violence is silly. Instead of killing the Gorn in the end, Kirk spares his life, and everybody's happy. The end. But that's is also the episode where we get the whole thing where Kirk makes a gun out of things he finds lying around, which is commented on in Galaxy Quest when guy says, "Look around, see if you can construct a rudimentary lathe."
That's a good line.
So anyway, this is interesting because they show the filming location, Vasquez Rocks, that they used in Star Trek, and then they have a couple scenes later them at Vasquez Rocks for a lot of this movie, actually, because this is where they die.
Yeah, they go there almost in like the next scene when the robots show up and like pretend to be helpful future Bills and Teds, and
yes,
then capture them and saying, "Come with us, we're gonna help you," and then they drive them out to the desert and push them off a mountain.
Yeah, what how many fingers will I hold up? Three. And then he holds the three. He's like, "Whoa, idiots." They
you don't think he had the fingers up already?
No, he didn't. You could see his hand.
I thought it was behind his back.
No, he said, "Will I?" They were supposed to predict what he would do, but because they were supposed to be future Bill and Ted's.
Yeah.
But he just says three, and then they just do three. Presumably because he was influenced by the, I guess. They go to the van, and quickly you realize something's wrong because they won't turn on the heat, and they say shut up and mean things.
They're big mean jerks, and he's like, "I got to remember in the future to be nicer." And you know, that's their gag that they use later in this movie and they use in the first movie, like, "I got to remember to do something in the future," and then it comes true then, because that's how their time loops work. You just got to think about it hard enough and it happens. But it doesn't happen here. Bill thinks about how he should be nicer, and then suddenly Ted is mean too.
Yeah. And then they arrive at Vasquez Rocks, and they realize that something is amiss, and Bill and Ted reveal that they are robots by doing the torso thing. After Bill punches evil Bill, and it doesn't work out for him. And there are some good split screens through this parts of the film, but then they give up on split screens when they're like, okay, so evil Ted grabs good Bill, and evil Bill grabs good Ted and walks them over to the cliff where they're going to die, because it would have been too problematic for them to have them being held by themselves.
The VFX supervisor on the movie already kind of had like his head in his hands, and he's like, "You want to do what now?" He's like, "No, can you just save us a couple of shots and just him grab the other guy and him grab the other guy and call it a day?"
Yeah. And so they walk them up to the top of Vasquez Rocks, and they're going to push them to their death. But Vasquez Rocks, if you're not familiar with, doesn't really have like a straight drop-off thing, so they kind of would have dropped and rolled down stuff. Like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it would have been a particularly immediately lethal fall as depicted in the film.
The whole movie's ruined because of that.
Yeah. Also, they call them some homophobic slurs with the F thing. And you're just like, oh, well, maybe that's just because they're evil. But then the good Bill and the good Ted call Satan that. And then you're just like, well, maybe that's because it's Satan. But I don't think you should call Satan names.
No, I think that was 1991. People not really with it.
No, this movie is definitely not woke. There are a number of problems in that department, and also with the misogyny, etc. throughout. Even when they're like trying to, you know, save the women from evil Bill and Ted, and evil Bill and Ted are depicted as being incredibly crude. It's still like they're not really that much better than them. They don't really like seem to respect them all that much in a kind and gentle way, and they're not written into the script with any real agency. They just kind of travel along with them as companions. Same for Missy, who gets a lovely line about looking down her top later when they're ghosts. But they get the whole thing of them being dead. They wake up with some day for night shot of them in the shadow of Vasquez Rocks, and William Sadler as Death appears.
I would just like to say, I'm glad that they gave him that other role too, so he didn't strictly have to be Death in the movie. But yeah, he's got some stuff to do in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I always like William Sadler in anything. He'll commit to whatever it is, as we saw in Die Hard 2, when mm-hmm. it's like, here's my butt.
Yeah, doing the naked kung fu in the hotel room.
Yes.
Has he done any other sort of comedic roles like this? Because he's got a fair amount of comedy that I think he executes pretty well.
I don't know. He's done a lot of stuff. If you look through
on his IMDb and scrolling through photos, and are you familiar with the fact that William Sadler was in Star Trek?
Yes, he played Agent Sloan, a member of Section 31, an evil-ish mm-hmm. kind of, well, not evil, but amoral division of Starfleet, where they just considered the ends justified the means. And he was good in that role.
I suppose he had a fair amount of tragic humor in Shawshank.
He was also in Rocket Man.
Oh my God, that's right, he was. Yep, there's the same highbrow level of comedy that's portrayed in this movie.
Yeah, where he played the straight man to Harlan Williams. So
he's the one who ate the hemorrhoid cream because the girl ate the toothpaste.
Oh.
I tried watching that again not too long ago because it was on TV, and I was like, I remember thinking this movie was kind of funny when I was a kid, and it was just like, oh man, the movies like that, like the Jim Carrey movies that are just like super slapstick and dated, yeah. Those movies are not easy to watch anymore.
Remember when they're on Mars and he's stuck under something and he's like, and Harlan Williams is like, a mother has, you know, strength to lift whatever, whenever her child is in danger, call me mother or whatever. Oh man, I still remember that dumb scene.
And then the scene where he's farting in a suit and it's inflating. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the like inflatable bubbles go down the tube into William Sadler's suit.
and then the space shuttle that looks like it's an escape room, where it's just some paint on some plywood. Man, that's
he gets stuck bad. In the space toilet and he turns all blue.
Oh, it's just. So
we should watch that movie one of these days, because it's just like, that's a drinking movie. You can't be sober and watch that movie.
No. Not like Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, but William Sadler appears as Death with sort of a German accent.
He's just kind of there. He's doing his job. He's not super into it. He's just kind of being ominous. And then he lets the guys know that they're allowed to challenge him to a contest or something to get out of it. Being the quick thinkers they are, they don't really come up with any contest. They just tell him that his shoes are untied, and they give him a Melvin, and then run away.
Yes, which is, as we see later on in the film, humorous.
A callback later.
Yeah, he doesn't have shoes. So,
well, that yes.
Mm-hmm. But no,
there's nothing like a good Melvin callback.
No. nothing like they really just for some reason get away from Death, even though Death seemingly moves quickly and appears behind them and all this other spooky stuff. They're just like Melvin and then run, which for some reason causes him pain. But they go back to town as ghosts, and wipe dirt off of the Porsche in front of their car. Oh, and there's also that sign, as you pointed out, where it's like San Fernando Valley 5 miles, Pasadena something something miles, and then San Dimas 50 miles. It's like, I don't think that's how that works from Vasquez Rocks. It's not 5 miles away from anyway. But they.
I also like that just San Dimas is on the road sign, because. Who gives a crap about San Dimas?
No one. But they
I do
actually...
like, however, the way that now that they're dead, that they have the production design team has given them monochromatic versions of their clothes, and the makeup team has very poorly painted their faces, sort of a dead gray color, and kind of like given much less attention to their necks and arms and things.
Yeah, and then there's sort of a blue light that's on them, but they go to their place and they see that Evil Robot Bill and Evil Robot Ted are disrespecting the princesses. I forgot to mention earlier, there is a moment where Bill talks about his robot Chubby. So that's in this film. Anyway.
They're anatomically correct robots so as to blend in they got to be able to fool everyone in every situation is the nice way to put it.
I guess it seems inessential to their mission, but they do
inessential robot wangs.
Yeah, they drive away the princesses through their grossness, and then they proceed to just be bad and dumb and stuff, and Bill and Ted can't do anything about it. Also, when the princesses leave, they walk through Bill and Ted, and you get some really horrible distortions
how are we going to make this effect look interesting?
Yeah, so while I had been complimentary to some of the split-screen stuff that they tried to do, this one, not so much. And they carefully step out of the way because they don't want to be walked through by their evil robots, apparently. I guess there's something intimate about that moment that would
be
wrong.
The effects supervisor again was just like, we got the one. Can we be okay with the one?
You guys want to save some money? They decide to go tell Bill's father, Ted's father, who's in charge of the police still for some reason, even though the last movie made anything clear, he's pretty incompetent. And they do this via possession, which they somehow realize that they can do while having no knowledge of that. Ted goes inside of his father, and then his father poorly explains in Ted's voice and intonations that there are evil robots from the future.
He does a pretty good job of being Keanu.
Yes. I have to say, I don't mind the fathers in the film. I don't think anybody's really like, I think everybody's trying to have fun, basically. At times, it doesn't seem like Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves are having a lot of fun, but it seems like everybody else is trying to have fun. Of course, you get... what's his name? The character actor guy who's next to him, who's in lots of stuff. Can't remember his name.
Guy's in other stuff?
Yeah. He's in lots of stuff. He's even in a Star Trek episode, actually. Star Trek Next Generation. But he's in Total Recall. Remember the kind of smarmy, like, Total Recall guy who works?
His name is... is he Roy Brocksmith or Hal Landon Jr.? He is Roy Brocksmith.
Okay, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay, he looks different in his other photos over here. I remember the Total Recall guy now.
Yeah, you recognize him now. You can go look up his Star Trek Next Generation credit, where he plays a game master who supervises a battleship game between one decommissioned starship and the Enterprise, where they've disabled the weapons. But then two Ferengi ships show up, and what are they going to do? Anyway,
he was also in Tango and Cash.
That's good.
Yeah,
I've never seen Tango and Cash.
I've seen parts of it. We should watch that too. It's you got Kurt Russell and you got Stallone, and they're a cop duo.
Oh, yikes!
Yeah, it's bound to be great.
Yeah. Or we could watch all the Star Trek episodes I've mentioned so far. But they have the great little acting moment of trying to describe the problems before they realize that's not working, and then they leave. and realize they need to get out, and they hit their heads, which gets the possessed versions of them squiggled back out. Which
just
again,
bang on one side of the head and it comes out the ear.
Yeah, which again doesn't make any sense. It's not like they have the Beetlejuice, you know, guidebook for the recently deceased or anything.
Well, it's simple. You just dive in.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And they also, for some reason, know how to manifest themselves as transparent apparitions and energy balls over the seance that Missy is having. And this is when Missy, I don't know, exorcises them or, I don't know, banishes
sends them straight to hell.
Yeah, she banishes them and they appear.
Nobody will listen to them. They keep telling everyone that they were killed. And that the robots have taken their place and they're going to ruin everything and you got to go help and arrest the bad guys and stuff. But nobody wants to hear it. So yeah, they try to communicate with Missy and tell her the same thing. And she's just, you know, like, you're ruining my fake seance dinner party here with my fancy friends. So I'm going to read this spell out of this book and ban you to hell.
Yeah. Yeah, and they even say, as ghosts, hello, new age dudes, which is nice for ghosts to do. But I only mention that to emphasize something we have not emphasized so far in our recording, and that is this movie was selected as part of Dudecember.
Welcome to Dudecember, everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
You have
everybody's
the
scratching.
Dudeliest.
Everybody's scratching their heads so far about, like, what could this be in reference to as part of their year of doing things? Well, now you have kind of an answer.
I feel like it's, it's no more of a cop-out than anything else we've done.
No. In fact, this movie features cops, but they get turned into cylindrical projections and then sent to hell. Hell is apparently a bunch of floating boulders on chains that Satan sometimes draws in and crushes with a robot dragon mouth.
Was it a dragon or was it like a big cow kind of looking thing?
I thought it was a dragon.
Yeah, maybe. Could be a dragon.
Yeah. I think you just have big cows on the brain because
I do have big cows on the brain. It's still sort of in my peripheral vision right here in my mentions on 3-5.
Listeners, please go to Dan Sturm's Twitter and look at the amazing videos that he has made recently, because I had humbly suggested that somebody should cut the Welcome to Jurassic Park moment with John Hammond to footage of the enormous cow that's in Australia. Dan did it, and it's amazing. It looks just as wonderful as you think it might be.
It was a good idea that you had there that you commissioned. And I was able to do it from my couch.
Yes. Well, it's actually easier to get YouTube videos with your iPhone than it is to get YouTube videos with your desktop computer.
Is it? How would you do it? I had to do some Googling, and I found a shortcut that lets you just you hit a button and then it saves it to Photos.
Yeah. I had that shortcut because I think Federico Vitici had posted that before.
See, I don't know how I missed that. I definitely read. Yeah. All of the things that he posts.
but anyway, that was the easy way to do that. On a desktop computer, it's much more difficult these days. YouTube likes to obscure things, but I like to use that thing that just pulls it down. But I did have to modify it for the audio stuff, as you did, it seems.
What did I do?
Didn't you have to modify it to pull down the audio stream with it?
The shortcut? No, it just did the thing.
Oh.
The reason the first one is silent is because I was looking at Imgur, and they their GIFs are now videos, but they don't, most of them don't carry sound. Some of them do now, and I saw your thing and I was like, oh yeah, that would be funny. And then I was scrolling through and I literally saw the big cow GIF there, and I was like, all right, fine. And I hit save, and then I was still in the app and I searched for Welcome to Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. And it was some other stupid parody thing, and I just saved that, but it also didn't have any audio. And I was like, you know, whatever. I'm not going to put much effort into this. And then I didn't. And then I was like, you know what? It's got to be an easy way to do this, because you can get real work done on iOS. So I found the shortcut. And then I downloaded the thing. I was like, oh, this is real easy. Just, you know, little J edit, and you're done.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth it with the sound.
Yes, definitely. It's much better with the sound. I almost deleted the old one, but then it wouldn't have made any sense that the caption on it was, okay, it's better with sound.
Yeah. Besides, you can see the progression, the workmanlike approach that you took.
You get your rough cut, you get your first version, you get your round of notes there from myself, and then final version there.
It was good.
Although, I should go back and clean it up because the black bars don't match in the top and bottom of the movie clips.
I mean, that kind of bothers me. Also, I don't like how there's that camera cut in there. I wish you had cut to like a reaction shot in between. But
like what cut?
You know how the cow is there? And then it cuts to...
Oh, there's two shots of the cow?
Yeah. It should like cut to a reaction shot instead of jump cutting on the cow.
Well, the first shot wasn't long enough on the cow. Like those two shots, I didn't cut those two shots together. That was straight out of the news clip. No, the clip I found of the cow had like a big lower third from some news agency that said like, holy cow. So I punched the cow in like 185% or whatever to get that lower third out of there. And it just so happened that the framing was still kind of perfect without having to reposition it too much.
Yeah. Well, it was still lovely. But back to this movie.
Behind the scenes, cow editing.
For some reason, they decide that they want to talk to Satan to try to convince him to let them not be there anymore.
Yeah, they beat Death at his game, and they're just trying to get back. So,
they didn't beat Death yet.
They didn't beat Death yet?
No, that happens later.
I thought that was the first. Oh, they gave him the wedgie first.
Yeah, they beat Death when they get out of hell. But first, they decide to go talk to Satan about their problem. And Satan kind of doesn't care, and he draws the boulder in to be crushed, and they hop up onto the robot dragon. And then for some reason, Satan has a trapdoor on his robot dragon. I guess maybe there are a lot of people who go up there on occasion. But anyway, you hear the booming, gravelly voice of Frank Welker as Satan, inviting them to stay there for eternity and suffer and whatever. And they get sucked into the air ducts of hell, where they just kind of fumble around in these maze-like tunnels, full of ventilation ductwork things. And then they go into some door, and it has one of the major colonel guys, whatever, who they recognize from, what was it, JROTC or something?
The dude?
Yeah, the military guy, the colonel, what's his face?
Yeah, he's the one that Ted's dad, even in the first movie, was threatening to send him off to military school if he didn't do good on his tests or whatever.
Colonel Oates.
Colonel Oates.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he is there being all stuff, and the design of everything is off-kilter and weird and... quasi,
it's very sort of like Tim Burton-y.
Yeah, I was gonna say quasi Beetlejuice-esque, where they went for the German expressionism angle
on all of the bunk beds behind them, and not really a ton else. Well, I guess they have the rafters that are kind of floating in black space with no real roof there.
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff in here that is very like German expressionist, but by way of Tim Burton. If you haven't seen The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, then just look at some screenshots because it's boring. But that is the source of
and
much
now
of...
now you have a film degree.
Yeah. That is the source of much of Tim Burton's inspiration. So they have to do infinity push-ups, and then they realize that that's not going to be tenable. So they split up so that way they won't be harassed as much by one thing. But this
great plan when you're in hell, split up, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Bill and Ted are idiots, so what do you expect? But they split up so that Bill is trapped at his granny's, what was it, her birthday party or something?
Yeah, they're kids, and it's her birthday, and yeah. She wants a kiss from little Bill, and she's got
whiskers,
gross brown teeth, and yeah. Mm-hmm. Whiskers and stuff.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. It's childhood terror.
Yeah. And similarly, at the same time, Ted has the Easter Bunny to contend with, which is an animatronic nightmare thing. And I should say at this point that the first time I saw this movie, I believe I was at a summer camp where the camp counselors just put on old movies that they had on tape to entertain children because they had nothing else better to do to distract us. And which is how I saw, I think, Caddyshack 2, Tron, Flash Gordon, Hook, and this for the first time for each of those. But anyway, this was mildly terrifying as a child because you see the sort of cartoonish, garish, overblown graphicness of it. But as an adult, this is incredibly boring to watch. This whole entire hell scene is so boring.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and it's not terrifying. It's like, yeah, pick your hell. Is it, being chastised by the Easter Bunny for eating your brother's candy or doing push-ups or Granny wants to kiss you and she's kind of gross?
It really doesn't seem that bad, but they seem troubled by it. They escape back to the air ducts and they're chased by these representations until they come to one of the junctions where the Easter Bunny is hopping down one side, Colonel is coming down one, and then the Granny is running towards them from the other angle, and then they finally say that they challenge Death to the duel, and then everything goes to black, and Death is there. And they say, yeah, we'll do the thing, and he's like, if you fail, you'll spend eternity in hell. And it's like, well, I don't see what the downside of that is, really, at this point, because they are in hell for eternity, so is it a punishment? That is worse than being there already? No.
They're still kind of in Hell's waiting room deciding where they're going to go, but yeah.
I guess. Hell's ductwork. But they agree, and so they go to the German Expressionist home of Death, and his is all blue and stone and stuff, and we see the humorous playing of the game, which is Battleship.
Yeah, it finally... the contest or whatever, so they play him 2-on-1 in Battleship and beat him.
Yes, and then he says best 2 out of 3, and then they
I play Clue. Yeah.
And then they beat him at Twister, and they beat him at what was it? What were the other ones? It was Clue, Twister, and
I thought they stopped when he said 4 out of 7 or whatever. Or did they actually do a fourth game?
Well, they had the little football thing and some of the in-between.
Oh, yeah, the little hockey guys on the magnetic thing that bounce around.
Yeah, and some of the in-between stuff is implied via editing. But anyway, they kick his butt a lot at everything, basically, which is strange, considering how inept they are at literally everything in their lives and how this is Death. But they comically beat him, and they are going to be able to go back to the real world, except that they realize that if they go back to the real world, they'll just die again, because there's no way that they can beat the robots from the future. And so they ask Death to help them stop the evil robots from the future by helping them make good robots.
Because apparently the part of the rule, in addition to if you best Death, he gets to let you go, he is also in your service for an indeterminate amount of time, apparently.
Yeah, that was not made clear earlier. But
it's a cool like bonus that they threw in. They're like, oh, you get to live, and also I got to help you matter what you ask for.
Yeah.
Although, you know, at a certain point, Death sort of seems to like them. And he enjoys his time with them. They're exposing him to some fun new things.
Yeah, although I have to question, if he's Death, and he's supposed to appear when everybody dies, shouldn't he be a lot busier than he is?
I like to imagine he can project, so there are multiple versions of him around the place.
I guess there could be like multiple timelines of Death going around, you know? It's not like he has to move in a linear fashion. Throughout all of the deaths that are occurring, but
it could be more than one pasty bald guy with a sickle too.
Yes, but then he'd be called Death, one of the deaths, instead of like Death.
Well, I mean, maybe Death is the plural of Death, so
maybe it's like Station, and there are a bunch of deaths, and then they all slam together into one giant Death. But
They slam together and turn into a mega death.
Oh, Dan.
Get it? Because Megadeth is a metal band they like, who was also in this movie, apparently.
Oh, that is so good, Dan.
Yeah, I think actually one of the Megadeth album covers was just like a giant skeleton type thing in a robe.
Sure.
Yeah.
But they go to Fong Heaven now. And it has weird platform floaty things, and there are people there that are flight attendants that seem to run the brochure handing out part of heaven, and then there's some guy with a quill, and then they rob some Amish people of their pastel clothes, and then they go to heaven and have their audience before God, where they incompetently explain what they had done through the movie so far.
They also had to get past the gatekeeper who asked what the meaning of life is, and they recite the lines to Every Rose Has Its Thorn.
Yes.
By Poison, which is apparently poetic wisdom.
Well, it's like in the first movie where they're talking to Socrates and they start quoting, "All we are is dust in the wind."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they have their audience before God and say all this incompetent stuff, and then God says, "Station," and then sends down a little floaty Wizard of Oz blue blob purple thing, and then it turns into plexiglass, and they pick that up and interpret that somehow to be the person they got to go meet, who is, it turns out to be two aliens, which Death says, you know, you expected them to, you expected the best scientists in the universe to be from Earth, but Station is playing charades with Albert Einstein and some others.
Yeah, and yeah. Station is a, what is it? It's like a little like mole gremlin thing with a giant butt.
Yeah, giant butt and huge nose and weird, gross hair. It kind of looks like a troll doll if you flatten the hair and made it like ran it through some dirt.
Yeah, if a troll doll like fell asleep under a sun lamp or like in a tanning bed for like a day.
It's incredibly unpleasant to look at, but they spent a lot of money on two small animatronic puppets and then one larger animatronic puppet. But they have the charade scene, and then they appeal to Station to go with them, and Station agrees, I guess because Station's bored in heaven. I don't know how this works out for Station after they get back to Earth. Does Station stay alive for another lifetime, or until Station dies of causes?
I think he's part of the crew now. He's hanging out until further notice.
Interesting. So anyway, they go back down to Earth. And
wasn't he playing the bongos too in the show? Like he's part of the band.
Yes, the bongos are an essential element of any metal band. But
any Kiss song, you gotta have your bongos.
Well, which I thought was funny because they're moving their hands around, but there are no bongos playing. But they Bill and Ted materialize back on Earth at the point of their death in seemingly fully healed and not at all bleeding or wounded or left in the desert for 3 days. Bodies, and they
there's a worm in his ear.
Gross. Yeah, they have Station and Death with them, and they take the van, and they go to the hardware emporium. And one of my favorite little moments in the film is when William Sadler is passing the guy who's coughing, and he says, "See you soon." But that's just a nice little underplayed. Little moment, which I think is why I like it as opposed to everything else, which is just sort of we don't care how we play it. But meanwhile, evil stuff is happening with the robots who are going to kidnap the girlfriends that they drove away with their bad breath because they're bad, so they have bad. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense. But they incapacitate them and Missy and stuff, and they take the princesses with them to the dance thing. The Battle of the Bands at the Civic Auditorium. Because it's not enough to merely kill Bill and Ted. You have to ruin their reputation, according to, you know.
Well, they're programmed to be as bad as possible. And they're like, you know, it would be really bad after we ruined the future and these guys' lives. Let's just kill these ladies.
Yeah. And so they hang them from the rafters and stuff, and they're going to ruin the performance and thus ruin Wild Stallion's chances. But Bill and Ted show up with the robots assembled by Huge Station from merging, the Uber station. And they, the robots don't look fantastic by any stretch of the imagination, but they look a little more handmade.
They're very 90s. I wouldn't even know how to describe their style.
I would say Captain EO, basically. You ever do the Captain EO experience at Epcot?
I did. I was very, very small, but I'm certain that I did.
Yeah. But directed by Stan Winston. Did you know that?
No, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah. But they do their thing, and the good robots beat up the bad robots, and we're just like, yay! Great. Let's end this, please.
They just like walk up and just like punch their heads off, and then...
It's called an uppercut.
And then they do something else. It wasn't really a punch to just make their bodies explode. It was really weird.
Yeah, this is very... I question how they're assembled. But Chuck Deanomalos appears in the phone booth, and he's being all evil and stuff, and he uses his big old gun to turn on every television in the world to look at their feed of what's happening now instead of, I don't know, just shooting Bill and Ted.
Well, he wants the world to witness their downfall, and this is where we come to the portion of the movie which is based on the Streisand effect, wherein he attempts to ruin them in front of a global audience, and in fact he's the one that gets pie in the face, and then they play a really good Kiss cover, and then everyone in the world was like, you know what, these guys are pretty good. I think I'm going to follow their teachings for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And then world peace is created by the attempts to stop them.
Yes.
So he was thwarted by his own plan.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever heard of the bootstrap paradox?
Probably, but no.
Okay, so basically, somebody really likes listening to Beethoven. He goes back in time, discovers that there's nobody named Beethoven who's alive, but he knows everything about Beethoven. So he does all of Beethoven's stuff, and thus Beethoven and his music.
He becomes Beethoven, or he's just like walking around talking to everybody, going like, no, there's this dude. He's really great. He plays this one song. It goes like, you know who I'm talking about? And everyone's like, no, but that sounds like a really cool idea. And then one guy just becomes Beethoven.
No. Yeah. He, the time traveler, who knows everything about Beethoven, goes back in time and realizes that Beethoven is important, so he just becomes Beethoven because he doesn't exist. And thus, Beethoven exists because that guy went back in time. So that's the bootstrap paradox.
So he's his own grandfather.
Yes, exactly. You kind of have a little bit of that here, where it's like, Wild Stallions kind of only take off because Chuck Deanomalos tried to defeat them, but Chuck Deanomalos should have actually known that, though.
He should have just let them be really bad at the Battle of the Bands.
Yeah, because they never, according to Rufus, who reveals himself as Pam Grier here by unzipping his chest, Rufus tells everybody that he's been Pam Grier all along, and that he was why they got into the thing, because nobody would have let them in because they sucked. And so somehow...
He was rigging it.
Yeah, this is all rigged because of people from the future. So if those people from the future didn't go back into the past to do this, it would have been a paradox, because they wouldn't have competed in the... They wouldn't have been able to compete in the Battle of the Bands, period, at all. Let alone the whole broadcast to the world thing, or the go train for 16 months thing instead of whatever it was they did from the last movie till now.
Where did they go to train that was better than whatever they had been doing?
Well, it's not entirely clear, although they mentioned medieval stuff, and then they mention babies, which they have in big little like backpacks. There's nothing that this franchise needed more than babies.
Typically you would want to put the baby on the front, because you don't want to like accidentally sit down in a chair and then squish it.
Did the baby Bjorn exist yet?
That is a good question. I'm going to real-time fact check that. Baby Jorn. I need a Wikipedia page for Baby Bjorn. Here we are. Baby Bjorn is a Swedish family-owned specializing products manufacturing, marketing of baby products. It was founded in 1961.
Hmm. Okay, so it did exist.
I mean, at least the company did.
Mm-hmm.
Who made that Baby Bjorn? New York Times article from 2012. It's very possible that it was, you know. Oh, paywalled. Sorry.
Mm.
Mm.
We'll never know. But anyway, they stop Chuck through a convoluted means of the thing of explaining how they're going to do stuff when they
they're going to think through things. They drop a sandbag to knock his gun out of his hand and pin it to the ground. And apparently, the sandbag is too heavy for him to just, you know, reach down and grab the gun. And then they drop a cage on him. And then they use their mind tricks to make him think that he has the same ability, but only the winner has the ability. So they gave him the key to trick him, but then they also gave him the second gun, but the second gun was fake.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is dumb. But anyway, they did that. Thus concludes the thing after their training sesh, and they play before the entire planet, which is somehow still watching on their TVs.
Yeah, they're all just like nodding along. They're like, yeah, they defeated that guy. That's great.
Yeah, so, you know, but you do get the little Reaper rap, which is notable.
When he steps away from his upright bass that he's playing in this rock band.
Yes. Better than the bongos. They play the Kiss song over the thing into the end credits. That was the last anyone ever saw of Bill and Ted, despite Alex Winter's attempts to restart the franchise.
I think they're doing the third one.
Well, they keep saying that, but they've been saying that for like years.
I think they finally they got a script or whatever. It's in the little news section here.
Yeah, I know. I know. They like literal years that they've said they've stuff.
And for the record, they should not make another one of those movies. No good will come of that, because they're going to have to act like stupid teenagers. Only now they're in their 40s, 50s, so that would be bad.
Or they are now sensible adults and they have to raise their teenagers who are.
But then
like
it's not
them.
A Bill and Ted movie.
Well, the kids will just be named Bill Jr. and Ted Jr.
No, because then you get into a Dumb and Dumberer situation. Mm-hmm. And that's not good.
It's going to happen, Dan.
It shouldn't.
No, but I bet you, because these writers. Not skilled. I bet you.
Did you see Dumb and Dumberer?
No. Do you know why?
Because it was dumb?
Yes.
I saw it in a theater.
Oh.
And I saw it with a man. There was one part of the movie where something incredibly stupid happened, and it wasn't really that funny, but it caught me off guard because I was very much not expecting it to happen. And I laughed out loud, incredibly loudly, as the only person to laugh at this section of the movie. Amanda died of embarrassment. I think she hit me. Because I was just embarrassing her by just like bursting out with laughter. It's just one incredibly dumb thing.
Well, now I'm kind of curious what that was, because I can't imagine that she would be embarrassed merely from a moment in you dragging her to see this movie, as opposed to seeing this movie at all.
Well, no, it's just the fact that the theater was like utterly silent except for me just like laughing at the top of my lungs. But no, they get put in this sort of like, you know, in the Animal House way, where they take the nerd kids and they put them all on the one couch in the other room so they don't get involved with the other the good frat boys. They have their own like class in like the shed, and one of the other sort of rejected students is this like football player who has like permanent concussions or whatever, so he's just unconscious most of the time on his desk. But at one point, the football player like wakes up and snaps out of it and screams like hike or whatever, and then he runs straight at a wall. And I don't know what I expected to happen, but I think he just slams into the wall and then falls over backwards. And I thought they were just going to do like, oh, he runs through the wall like Donald Duck style or something. But just the way he like smashed into this wall and fell over backwards onto the ground just caught me so off guard that I burst out laughing, and I was literally the only person in this giant theater. Everyone else was silent and just probably wondering what was wrong with me.
Okay. Team Amanda on this one.
Yeah. Well, you had to be there. You had to see it to really appreciate the sight gag.
Had to be there. I'll be sure to watch that just for that. But anyway, this movie, we've discussed it and it's done now.
Yeah. Final judgments on Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Yeah.
They do say bogus a couple of times. I at least remember to get the title in there.
Yeah. But
bogus is bad, apparently.
Here's the thing. No, this one did not work out.
Was the journey not bogus enough for you?
The journey was very bogus, but not in the way that they had intended. You know, when there's something that's unintentionally funny, this is unintentionally bogus. Where they were going for this is a journey that's not great for our characters. Whereas I feel like this is a journey that's not great for the audience. Because the movie is, as I said, really poorly written. The pacing is awful. There's the entire portion of the film that just stretches on forever where they're in hell that does nothing, really. As an adult, there's nothing in there to really hold on to as either character development or as something scary. It is absent from that. Although I will say again, as a kid, there's something weird about that whole entire thing being, it's very unsettling just visually, but it's just too silly to work. And none of the rules they make for world building for all of this stuff, for their death or for what,
or
they
world building. This is the real world that we live in.
Yes. Well, I mean, the first movie, you kind of got a sense of how time travel worked. Like, you looked up the time you were going to go to, and you punched it into the thing, and then the thing went back through the stuff, and it had a little antenna thing on top. And then when the antenna thing broke, you just put pudding cup parts on it. And then that's how you solve the antenna thing. And, you know, they had comedy that came from historical figures in the modern day, such as Napoleon. Ziggy Piggy, but they had comedy from that. Whereas in this one, we're supposed to be laughing at the torturous predicaments that our main characters keep winding up in. But our main characters are so bad that it's hard to laugh at them being put through these situations because we think they're just so dumb that they should just know better because these situations are so awful. Whereas in the first one, the stakes are very low. So them being dumb about certain things, them not understanding stuff, that's fine and it works for comedy. But in this one, where it's like literal death, those are the stakes, then it's not as funny, I feel like. And you just wind up with a comedy movie that drags as opposed to a dramatic movie.
Mm-hmm. It's just stupid.
Yeah, it's really just bad. And even when they try to be clever at their most clever moments, like the game stuff with death, I think is probably the highlight of the film. And I put a lot of that down to the games that were selected, mm-hmm. as well as the acting from Alex Winter, Keanu Reeves, and William Sadler for how they were going to do the whole thing.
Yeah, but you, pretty quickly you get it. Like, you don't need as much as we had there.
No, and everything in heaven is incredibly boring. And I know that theologically someone could argue that heaven is supposed to be boring, but
don't bring theology into this podcast.
Yeah, but it's just, it doesn't need to be boring on film for all of us to watch. There's nothing, there is nothing from the heaven scenes that means anything or turns into anything or matters to these characters or impacts them severely. Like, they go there to get a thing, they get the thing, and then they leave. There's no conflict or character development that occurs while they're in heaven. They just stumble through scenes, and then they're out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we're done.
I got nothing for this movie. I mean, it's like you described what we got there. There's you got your music, you got your rock and roll music. So it doesn't end with any cringy, disturbing 80s rock this time, as far as I can tell. But
I mean, there's plenty of cringy, disturbing everything in this, though.
Mm-hmm. So. I looked at the soundtrack list here on IMDb, and I don't remember a lot of these songs being there. Oh, Primus was there at the Battle of the Bands, which mm-hmm. I hate Primus. I don't like any of their music. I never have. So I'm glad they lost, I guess, but I didn't need to sit through, I don't know, like 30 seconds of whatever the hell that song was they played.
Yeah, I don't like Primus either, but they're famous, I guess, for the South Park theme, so good for them.
Yeah, congratulations. No, like they used to be on the radio back in the Faith No More days too, with their, what was their, so Jerry was a race car driver and there was another one. Like their songs are not good. They're just testing you. They're saying, go ahead, change channel. I dare you.
Yeah. So, I think we have rendered a verdict.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've kicked off December with hopefully the low water mark, and then we can build from here.
I don't know. We've got a list of the other December movies that I'm looking at, and I'm like, maybe this is gonna be on par with this one. Is that how that works? The golf metaphor? Am I using on par correctly?
On par, yeah. On equal ground, yes.
Yes, yes. Okay, yes. Great. So,
I don't think on par is strictly a golf term, is it?
I thought it was.
Maybe.
Yeah. Dude, what's my on par? But anyway,
dude, how's your December?
It's the December to remember event.
is a December a thing?
No. That's not a word.
Sember.
No.
Is it?
Sem's not a word. Burr's kind of. You could say a word, but you'd spell it differently.
It when I searched it in the little dictionary on my computer, it kicked me over to something I can't pronounce, but it's a village in Azerbaijan.
Oh, good. Well, I mean, I frequently talk about villages that are in Azerbaijan.
Semberexak.
Okay. Good luck rhyming that one.
Yeah. Dude, where's my Semberexak? I seem to have lost my village in Azerbaijan.
Oh, I'm so sorry. But yeah. Now let's air guitar ourselves out of here.
The Duke of Spook, the Doctor Shock, man with no chance, please say hello to death himself. The Grim Reaper! King or a little street sweeper, but sooner or later you dance with the Reaper. Get down with your bed, sir. I love show business.